Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, in our first show of the new year, 2021, we want to step back and assess what's happened. Well, a lot's happened. But the topic of the show is going to be Trump's economic and political legacies. I might add toxic legacies. What has been accomplished and for whom over the last 4 years in terms of economics and politics? You know, we've been focused a lot on the political crisis here this past week. That's certainly one of his political legacies, isn't it? It's sort of the culmination, what happened here in Congress, the culmination of the attack on democracy that is the hallmark, political hallmark of the Trump years. Well, that's a legacy, isn't it? The weakening of democratic norms and institutions and democratic practices in the U.S. He certainly undermined that. That's a major political legacy. But I want to talk first about the economic legacies, and then we'll come back to the political legacies. Okay, so what can we summarize here as Trump's legacies of the past 4 years? And for whom? You know, they're not all total failures. They've been quite successful for certain interests. So he hasn't failed everywhere economically. He's delivered for the wealthy, for the big corporations. Well, the number one economic legacy, I think, as we look back on the Trump years, is going to be his massive tax cuts that benefited overwhelmingly, like 90% benefited big corporations, small businesses too, investors in particular, multinational corporations, and the wealthiest 1% households, who are the major investors, the investor class. You know, we've heard time and time again, and the media has misrepresented the full scope and magnitude of the Trump tax cuts that were driven through Congress in late 2017, a massive bill that the Democrats never even got to look at before it was rammed down their throats, because at that time, Trump and the Republicans controlled both the Senate and the House, and it was implemented quickly in January 2018. We kept hearing it was only $1.5 trillion. I kept analyzing and explaining, no, it's over $4 trillion. It's not one and a half. But even the mainstream economist and mainstream media kept saying $1.5 trillion. Here's why it wasn't. Here's why it was more than $4 trillion. The $1.5 trillion was based on the assumption that the economy would grow over the next 10 years at an average of more than 3 to 4% GDP. And there was a massive growth, you know, unprecedented, never existed for 10 years. That would generate more tax revenues, the false assumption went, that would reduce the actual amount of the tax cut to the $1.5 trillion. In other words, this massive growth would generate more, a trillion or more revenues a year. So the $2.5 trillion, in reality, absolute of the tax cuts, would only be $1.5 trillion. That was the one big assumption and false representation of that tax cut. The other, there's another one that is just as great. And that was the ignoring of the full extent of the tax cuts for multinational U.S. corporations and their offshore operations. You know, the tax rate was 35% for corporations before this tax cut. After the tax cut, multinational corporations were able to get away with paying 10% or less on their offshore operations. they could bring back the $4 trillion they had stuffed overseas in their offshore subsidiaries at 10%. And that's before their loopholes. And on top of that, their profits going forward would be taxed at a rate in which it was maybe 15%, 10 to 15%, around 12%, but offset by the taxes U.S. multinationals paid to their local countries offshore. So that, too, was below 10%. In other words, it virtually disappeared. Taxation offshore disappeared. That was at least $2 trillion in tax cuts. Never gets reported in that false indication of the Trump tax cuts, only 1.5%. So both the false assumption of GDP growth, which of course we know hasn't grown 3%, has it? No. We have in the first year, well, second year, 2020, in the second year, a massive Great Recession 2.0, worse than the Great Recession of 2008-09. That has collapsed revenues. So even so, if you look at in the first year, 2018, the 19 of the Trump tax cuts, you know, the argument is, oh, you give business the tax cuts, they'll have more money on hand, and therefore they will invest more, and that will create more economic activity. They'll hire more people, they'll have more money, and they will spend more, and that will boost GDP. That's the false lie, you see. Tax cuts, business tax cuts, never create jobs in the short run. Never. If you look at the past 40 years, these tax cuts did not create jobs, and they dissipate fairly quickly. But even this tax cut did not generate investment that the whole argument is based upon. Look at what happened in 2019. Real business investment contracted 9 months in a row, actually contracted, even though these tax cuts were there. Business got extra money, but they didn't invest it in job-creating activity and production. What did they do with it? Well, they gave it to their shareholders. How much did they give? $1.3 trillion a year for 2 years, 2018 to 19. $1.3 trillion in stock buybacks and dividend payouts to their wealthy shareholders, which in the tech industry means top management. $1.3 trillion was distributed. That was where the tax cut went. Well, what did those people then do with that massive tax windfall? Well, they didn't reinvest it, at least not in the U.S., in real activity that would generate production and jobs. No. They invested it in the stock market and other financial asset markets, not just in the U.S., but around the world. That's why we got such a boom in the bubble in the stock markets. Huge amount of redistribution of income to the wealthy 1%, the investor class, from their corporations because of the massive tax cuts producing this huge money windfall in corporations. Of course, all that means accelerating income inequality, doesn't it? Well, you know, the wealthy investment class loved Trump for that. And that's why they let him go in the first 2-3 years and let him do all his nonsense. He rewarded them nicely. And not just multinational corporations and big corporations, even small business got a big windfall. You know, the pass-through provision allowed them to pay no more than 20%. Capital gains, dividends, 20%. Capital gains tax and dividend taxation, the difference was cut to 20%. And that's all before they find loopholes, you see, and it goes down even less. So this massive income redistribution been going on under Trump. made possible by the tax system and his massive tax cuts of 2018. That, by far, is the biggest economic legacy of Trump. And I would reiterate, it's why they put up with him a lot for as long as they did. Now, we will see whether that legacy continues under Biden. Biden, you know, during the election campaign said he was going to reverse it. Well, now the indications are they're just going to chip away a little at it. You see, instead of reducing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20% or 25%, he's going to reduce it to 28. And that's before, of course, they get negotiating with the Republicans in Congress. They'll tweak it. They'll chip away at it. But they won't really reverse it. And that's a big legacy for the wealthy, for the 1% investor class. A major legacy of the Trump economic years here. Okay, moving on from the tax cuts, what's another legacy? Well, the gutting of deregulation all across the board, not just environmental, but just about every area of regulation, government regulation you can think of. That was gutted under Trump. Will they restore it? Well, we will see. He can do it. Biden can do it by executive order. He'll probably do much of it in environmental. But we'll see whether he does this reversal of the deregulation in other areas, economic areas. But that was a great legacy, again, benefiting the corporations and the wealthiest class in the country. What else? Trade war. Trump's trade wars. Is that a legacy? Yes, that's a legacy, but not so great a legacy for some sectors of the capitalist class. Others did better. The Trump wars were kind of phony, except for China. Well, what did he achieve in the trade war with China? Well, he did make some achievements there. One was the Chinese were willing to open up their economy to U.S. banks and financial investors, and also to allow 51% ownership of U.S. operations in China. That's why Tesla's moving over there, you see. You know, his production increase is going to be in China, and a lot of other companies, too. You know, 51% ownership. By the way, the Chinese granted this not just to the U.S. as a result of negotiations with Trump. In fact, they granted it to European capitalists and others even before they agreed to do it with Trump. And they signaled from the very beginning they would do that, with Trump here, 51% ownership, let the financial big U.S. banks get in under the tent there in China. That's about all they achieved, though, you see. Trump's trade war was supposed to generate $100 billion more a year in purchase of U.S. goods by China. $100 billion a year on top of the roughly $40 billion. And much of that would be in agriculture and gas, gas and oil and gas, and manufacturing. Well, you look at the record, what do we got here? Maybe 10, 20 billion more in food farm purchases. Not very much. Pretty much where it was before, maybe a little bit more. And that required Trump to placate his farm base by providing them massive subsidies from the U.S. Treasury. How much? Well, about $70 billion in direct subsidy payments, much of them to U.S. agribusiness, you see. Under Trump. That's a legacy. That's a legacy as well. In other words, he failed pretty much when it comes to trade wars, particularly with China. He got what China was already offering before. He didn't get the big purchases. Hey, look, what is the monthly trade deficit of the U.S. here, just announced, the most recent? We're running a trade deficit with the world of $85 billion a month. That's almost $1 trillion a year. What's China's trade surplus with the world? $75 billion up. So China goes way up. The U.S. goes way down in terms of trade balances. Was that a victory? Was that a legacy? No. Nope. A big failure. But certain industries benefited in the U.S. from the trade war. The steel industry, for example, and aluminum industry benefited by the tariffs. And studies show they passed all of that benefit on in price increases for their products. So Americans paid for those tariffs, not the Chinese or the Canadians or, you know, anyone else. The U.S. Traded steel and aluminum products. What about the NAFTA 2.0 or USMC that they call it, you know, the new trade agreements? Well, that was a big phony tweak. Nothing really changed much there. So on the trade front, Trump accomplished very little. And in fact, probably disturbed and disrupted trade relations with U.S. allies more than anything. But, you know, the big banks and the big multinational corporations got into China deeper. That's about all it achieved. You know, as I wrote many times here over the past couple of years and in my latest book this past year, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump, the trade war with China was really a tech war. The U.S. really wanted to stop China developing in the new next generation technologies, you know, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and 5G. That was the real objective. What Trump did was merge the tech war against China with a trade war and try to use one to leverage with the other. Well, the Chinese weren't stupid, and they weren't going to agree to any limitations on their tech development, because that's the next field of military superiority over the next decade. So Trump got nothing. He got absolutely nothing from the Chinese on the tech war. And he had to decouple to get he had to decouple the tech demands of the U.S. Trade team from the economic demands of the U.S. trade team to get this you know, mini deal with China at the end of 2019, this mini trade deal to save face. And the Chinese gave him what they had already told them a year before they would give him, the access, 51%, and the banks. Access to China. So he really got nothing. He got nothing. And the whole idea was, well, we were going to come back in 2020 and really negotiate the tech war. Well, what's happened is a series of measures have been coming out over the past year and a half, you know, attacking Chinese companies, delisting them from the stock market, and pushing allies not to do business, you know, with 5G, with Huawei and others, Chinese companies. So they've been doing it on a company-by-company, measure-by-measure basis, but they never got a tech agreement with China, and they never will. So that was a legacy that was a real failure. You know, China and the U.S. are responsible for just about 90% of all the tech patents in the world. 90%. Everyone else is far behind. And the U.S. and China are about even. So we have a tech war with China that hasn't abated, that will continue here, and no doubt will continue under the Biden administration as well. Actual strategy and tactics to be determined. But this whole trade war, China tech war, another legacy of Trump, mostly failure. And at the cost of, you know, tens of billions of dollars and higher prices for businesses and consumers in the U.S. And that's going to be, that fallout's going to be with us for quite some time here. Another major economic legacy was Trump's attack on the Federal Reserve, the central bank in the United States, which in his first year was raising interest rates in preparation for the next recession. And then Trump, of course, even though the economy was doing well in 2017, put great pressure on the Fed and its chairman, Jerome Powell, to start lowering interest rates prematurely. You know, you lower interest rates by the Fed, you know, the bond rates, the treasury rates, the bills, bonds, and so forth. And what that has is the effect of reducing rates in the private markets. You know, I mean, the 10-year treasury bond is kind of a benchmark. So is the 5-year, 90-day bills and notes. And that when the Fed lowers those rates, it pushes down other rates. And in other words, provides free money for investors, or more free money, lower rate, lower cost money for investors. And that's what Trump did. He leaned heavily on Jerome Powell in late, I think it was 2018, and forced the Fed to reverse its policy of raising rates in preparation for the next recession and lower them prematurely. On top of the massive tax cuts, you see, Trump was trying to really overstimulate the economy. But the economy, you know, structurally is so weak, it wasn't able to really overstimulate the economy very much. But nonetheless, he tried, and he didn't succeed in that regard. But what we had was, when the recession really hit here in 2020, the Fed did not have much ammunition to lower interest rates even more. So what the Fed had to do was to throw money, called quantitative easing, at the markets and at businesses and the banks. And that's what it did this past spring. $120 billion injected by the Fed into the economy every month since March. And before that, by the way, it had injected $1.5 trillion to stabilize another market that was getting shaky in late 2019, called the repurchase agreement markets. So on top of the $1.5 trillion for that market, we then start $120 billion a month, every month, continuing. Now, that's free money. That's virtually free money, and it drives down the interest rates even further. And Fed interest rates had pretty much hit bottom. Any further, in real terms, they would have to go negative interest rates. So that's a legacy here. We've got a central bank, a Federal Reserve, that has shot all of its interest rate ammunition, and all it can do now is throw free money at the bankers and the investors. And not just the bankers and investors, but now at zombie corporations and exchange-traded funds and all the other speculative excesses that have been occurring, especially since this past March, creating bubbles in the stock market, making the investor class even more rich with capital gains, which they now pay minimal taxes for. You see how it all connects: the tax policies, the interest rate policies, the redistribution of stock buybacks that drive up the values in the stock market, the dividend payouts, and all that is all connected. And it's all about making the rich richer. And boy, have they gotten rich, even more so. You know, under Obama, the distribution of stock buybacks by corporations and dividend payouts was almost $1 trillion on average. Ever since the 2009 Great Recession 1.0 ended, the Fed and other ways continuing the Bush tax cuts under Obama had the effect of boosting the stock markets and enriching the 1%, almost $1 trillion. But under Trump, it accelerated even further, well over $1 trillion for 3 years in a row. You can see the connections here between Obama economic programs and measures, fiscal monetary policy, and the same connections, although on steroids now, under Trump. You know, these policies and this analysis I went into great detail in my Scourge of Neoliberalism book. So what we got here is a legacy in terms of the Fed and free money that's created stock market bubbles that are still bubbling. Yes, they're still bubbling. Well, why are they still bubbling? Well, the free money from, of course, the Fed. And as I've talked about in previous shows, not only the Fed generating free money, but with interest rates driven down as far as they could go in real terms, big corporations simply issued new corporate bonds, added up their debt, added to their total debt, which they're going to pay back in the future. How much this year? $2 trillion they've raised. That's just the Fortune 500 companies. $2 trillion in corporate bonds on top of the zero rates for borrowing. Well, where are they going to put all that cash that they got? Well, they didn't invest it in creating jobs. What did they do? Well, they sent some of it to China that's booming. And, of course, it went into financial assets, stocks and other assets. So we got this terrible financialization of the U.S. economy. All the money, not all, but much of the money generation here is flowing into financial assets because they're so much more profitable. That means we're not getting real investment in production that creates jobs for the rest of us. So one of the legacies is the further intensifying financialization of the U.S. economy under Trump, a trend that has been going on and building ever since Ronald Reagan, by the way. Okay, so stock market bubbles, right? Free money from the Fed, China, check war, general trade wars, deregulation, tax cuts. These are all legacies. And we'll see whether the Democrats will attempt to reverse them or just dabble with token adjustments to it all. And we shouldn't forget, of course, the funding of the military-industrial complex. While all this was going on, deficits were rising, not only because of the tax cuts and loss of revenue that I've talked about here, but also because increased spending for the Pentagon and for defense. $100 billion plus a year, every year for 3 years. Increase going on in terms of spending on war and defense. You know, the Pentagon budget is $740 billion this year. Now, you go back to the early 2000s, it was less than half of that. Half of that. And the wars have supposedly wound down, you know, in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places. But we're not seeing any cut in the Pentagon, are we? No, no. The U.S. pissed away at least $7 trillion on these wars in the Middle East. $7 trillion. You add that to the $15 trillion in tax cuts since 2001, and you got deficits of $22 trillion, which is just about the national debt total right now. Well, before 2020 and COVID, of course. Now it's about $27-28 trillion national debt. But, you know, $22 trillion, you can just war spending increases and tax cuts. Never in the history of the U.S. have we gone to such wars as we've had these wars of terror, as they call them, by cutting taxes. They've always raised taxes to some extent, to at least partially pay for the cost of the wars. No, no, not this time. U.S. capitalist class wants its cake and eat it, too. And what did they get? They got massive $15 trillion in tax cuts since 2001 and $7 trillion in war spending, you know, additional incremental war spending for U.S. wars. And will that change? No, no. They'll just shift the spending. You know, now the target, of course, is going to be China. You watch that. It's going to be China, and the U.S. will ramp up, particularly spending on equipment. They'll ramp it up. They'll ramp up cybersecurity spending. It's not going to go down. And by the way, the Pentagon spending is not total defense spending. That's only part of it. The U.S. spends over $1 trillion a year on, quote, defense, because some of the spending on the military does not go into the Pentagon budget. For example, all the military's expenditure on oil and energy, that comes out of the Energy Department budget. All of its spending on nuclear arms, that comes out of the Atomic Energy Department, you know, agency, whatever, right? Veteran spending, the VA. So there's all these other cubbyholes that respond or, you know, represent spending on defense, interest on the debt from the huge $1 trillion a year defense spending. The Homeland Security, that's in defense spending, not in the Pentagon. And, you know, the CIA, the NSA, and all of them have their secret military arms now, and you'll see part of the budget on defense, really in CIA, NSA, even the State Department, you know. Okay, so $1 trillion, and that's a legacy, not an original legacy. That's been going on for quite some time, but nonetheless continued and accelerated under Trump. You see, Trump is neoliberalism on steroids, really. All of these economic areas were kind of continuation, except, of course, for the trade wars, maybe. But the Republicans has always gut regulation and cut tax cuts on investors, right? They didn't always attack the Fed directly and force the Fed to lower interest rates. But they did it under Trump here, you know, which pretty much eliminates this fiction that the Federal Reserve is independent of the politicians. No, no. The Fed does the strategic shifts that the politicians wanted to do. So it's not independent. No, it's an arm of U.S. capitalist economic policy. Well, you know, those, I would say, are the major economic legacies. Again, just to sum up, the tax cuts, the deregulation, the trade wars, the tech war with China, the intimidation and manipulation of the Federal Reserve, stock market bubbles that just keep going because the free money just keeps going, you see. And the constant growth of the military-industrial complex and the war spending budget of the United States. In some cases, Trump just continued and accelerated these trends. But in others, you know, he went off in another direction. What we've got is legacies, new legacies here economically. All right, what about the political? What about the political legacies? What can we say about that? Well, obviously, it's right before us, right? The attack on democracy. And, you know, it didn't really begin with Trump. If you look back at least to the mid-1990s, you have the rise of this right wing penetrating the U.S. government. Growing in terms of influence, mid-1990s, it starts with Newt Gingrich and his takeover with his new congressman of the U.S. House of Representatives. Yeah. You know, he said directly, publicly, the whole purpose of his group was to create a, quote, dysfunctional government, so that people would no longer believe in compromise, but would turn and support their more extreme recommendations and policies. This is publicly stated by Gingrich. And, you know, this penetration of the radical right in government starts with him. Then we see other indications of a kind of atrophying of U.S. democracy. We saw it in 2000, didn't we, with Gore versus Bush and the Supreme Court selecting George W. Bush by stopping the vote count, a recount there in South Florida. And, of course, the Democrats, in this case Gore, went along with it. They didn't challenge it. You know, because there's this agreement between the two wings here of the corporate party of America. That's what I call it. There's a single party in this country with two wings called Republicans and Democrats, although I would call them Trump-publicans and Timid-crats, maybe. Those two wings, you know, they sort of are in agreement that they will trade off every 4 or 8 years, until Trump, of course. Trump made it clear he was not in favor of a trade-off, right? He was going to stay in power one way or another here. Of course, what happened this past week was kind of a overreach on his part. You know, I wrote a piece last weekend before January 6th events, and I said, look, Trump's strategy, this is really about Trump's fight to control the Republican Party. Clearly, you know, the odds of him staying in power were very low here once the Electoral College made its decision, but he fought anyway. And the whole purpose of Trump, I believe, you know, in this January 6th was to intimidate Congress and build the numbers of his supporters in Congress as a message to his troops out there in the hinterland that, look, you know, even most of Congress or much of Congress supports me that this election was stolen. You know, they started off with 12 senators going to challenge Electoral College, and then about 140 House representative members. And the whole idea of the demonstration on the 6th was to go down there and surround the Capitol and show the strength of the Trump support and get even more senators and representatives to come over, maybe a couple dozen senators, you know, maybe 20 more fence-sitting Republican House members, right? And to show that there was this massive support in Congress for Trump. The big demonstration was supposed to be January 20th. I think Trump was really planning not to leave the White House voluntarily. He was planning to have his supporters surround the White House and defend it and make the other powers that be drag him out of the White House, kicking and screaming in front of the cameras. That would solidify him as a great hero of the right once again, and intensify the message that, these people were undermining democracy here by removing Trump, for stealing an election from him and removing Trump. Trump would then come out being even a stronger control of the Republican Party, and he would be able to continue his dirty work outside of government and then take over Congress again, his minions in 2022, and run again in 2024. I think that was his strategy. You know, no one in their right mind would actually believe that after the Electoral College that the result would not be Biden being president. But Trump pursued this anyway. But what happened on January 6th was that he overreached, and it backfired. The mob went out of control. Was out of control, and it ransacked the Capitol, and that resulted in a big reversal of support for Trump. So the strategy, you know, when you turn the mob, the street politics loose, you can't always control that Kraken, and it went out of control. Very clearly, he told them to go down there and demonstrate aggressively. I don't think he told them to crash. Well, he didn't publicly, to crash and ransack the Capitol. But that's what they did. That's what they did. And, if you listen to those speeches by Trump the morning before, or in front of the White House there, or I forget where that park was, before they marched down to the Capitol building, Trump was careful not to be too insightful, but then Trump Jr. And Giuliani, you know, clearly told people to go down and be violent. And they're not playing those videos too much. But if you watch them, you can see these guys are really very stupidly incented this group to go down and take action. And that's what they did. And then, of course, you know, you got to ask yourself, why would 1,000 Capitol Police, why would 1,000 police simply open the doors to these people, which is what they did? 1,000 of them, 1,000 Capitol Police, where were they? Well, they weren't on the steps amassed saying, no, thou shalt not enter. No way. And then we have all these videos of them taking selfies with the mob, you know, and fraternizing with them like good old buddies and so forth, you know. Someone told those guys to stand down, I think, because they knew this was going to happen or could very much happen. In fact, Pelosi even told the head sergeant of arms, you know, there's a risk of something really violent occurring 3 days before. And they did nothing. They did nothing. Well, all the truth will come out. But, you know, this is not the sole legacy. Trump has been chipping away at democratic norms ever since he got in there, right? You know, the whole idea of he's taking money from the Pentagon and use it to build his wall, that's a violation of the Constitution. You can't take money from this cubbyhole and put it in this cubbyhole because Congress passes authorization bills saying where it's going to be spent. So he was just thumbing his nose to Congress and the House in particular and doing what the hell he wanted. And then there were other measures, you know, national emergency, this and that, excuses. He was running roughshod over Congress, refusing to allow anybody to testify, you know, in his cabinet testify before Congress. You know, the list of excesses under Trump were very clear in terms of you know, circumscribing democratic norms and even institutions and the division, separation of powers. Trump would have gone a long way. I think he had very clear dictatorial tendencies here. Ruling was all he wanted to do. And if he could have got away with stealing this election, he would have done it. He tried, but it was rather inept. You know, his attorneys were rather inept. They really didn't have the evidence. Maybe it was there, maybe it wasn't, but they sure weren't able to present it. You know, what we see is this legacy now of democracy under attack and the legitimization with tens of millions of people and voters in this country that it's okay now to take direct action and attack the institutions. We'll see where that goes. But that's going to be a difficult genie to put back in the bottle for the Democrats and the elite here going forward. You know, there's over 70 million out there, maybe 50 million, who still believe that the election was stolen. I don't know how they're going to re-educate that group. And Trump may end up in Mar-a-Lago here. I don't think they're going to pull a 25th Amendment or even impeach him. They should, even after he leaves, after January 20, because only by impeaching him after the fact can they prevent him from running again. If they don't impeach him, then he can run again in 2024. And we'll see what happens. But I'm not optimistic that the Democrats are going to really go after him, notwithstanding what Pelosi and Schumer are saying. I think Biden and his advisors would prefer Trump just to quietly go play golf for the next couple of weeks in Mar-a-Lago and leave it at that. And I think Trump would rather do that, too. And he's going to try to do that. We'll see what happens between now and then. But, you know, you can expect the let's prosecute Trump effort to dissipate here. I'll believe it when I see it, if they really go after him as they should. Because if they don't, it's a signal You can incite mobs to attack legislatures and courts and whatever, and you'll get away with it, you see? You'll get away with it. That's a message. If they don't do something, they're going to leave. Well, what about the other political legacies other than this legacy of it's okay to chip away and attack what's left of minimal U.S. capitalist democracy forms? What about that? Well, the other political legacy obviously is stacking the Supreme Court with ultra-conservatives, right? That's exactly what he did. And we're going to pay the price for that. You're going to see that. There's going to be more, when the dust settles here, there's going to be more court overturning of legislature from Congress, from the Democratic Congress, right? Institutionalizing white nationalism within the Republican Party. This is part of the Republican Party now. And what's going to happen, we'll see. But it's quite possible that that party might split in the next couple years. Certainly, we see already the move by the traditional elite in that party to try to take it back. They're going to try to do that. Whether they can or not remains to be seen, or whether Trump will be able to hold on to his leadership in that party when out of office. And that's the great battle behind the scenes going on here, you see. Because if he loses control of that party, then he's even more exposed in terms of the legal and financial attacks which are going to come after him. And his empire, his economic empire. We'll see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, very, very clearly, it's a party that's been radicalized by the right. And those two forces, those right-wing forces, those Trump forces versus the traditional Republicans, cannot long-term coexist, I think. What you've had, of course, is the traditional forces putting up with Trump and his supporters because Trump delivered on the tax cuts and other areas. And but now it's different, you see. Now it's very clear, the signal is very clear that the Trumpists, you know, those inheritors of Newt Gingrich's movement and the Tea Party movement under Bush and Obama, they're going even further. They're even becoming more radicalized. And they may have, they, meaning traditional Republicans, may leave and join the corporate wing of the Democrat Party. And if Biden does not deliver here what he needs to deliver, and I think the odds are against him delivering enough to really deal with the economic crisis, if he doesn't deliver, then you will see a growing force within the Democratic Party, the Progressive Caucus, you know, the Squad and others, that may be so disappointed with the corporate wing, you know, the Biden wing, that they go separately. That's less likely. But more likely is, come 2024, we may see at least a three-party race here. You know, the Trumpublicans, traditional Republican centrists, and the Democrats. Maybe four, if the progressive wing splits from the Democrats, though not likely. So at least three. That will change the equation electorally very interestingly here going forward. But that's a legacy of Trump, a political legacy of taking over the Republican Party. Now that fight is going to be more difficult for Trump because of what's happened here. It's definitely a setback for him, and it opens him up to, failing to control his party going forward. But we will see. You know, it's still very, very flexible. He still has the 70 million or 50 of the 70 million behind him, and that's a major force. You see, he's created that movement, that radical right movement, or they created him, or vice versa, or both. And very clearly, you know, he's not going away. Trumpism is not going away, whether Trump runs again or not, or some Trump clone runs again. Right now, you know, he looks weaker, and he is weaker. But that could drift back, within a matter of months, and certainly by 2022 midterm elections, because the Democrats, you know, are barely hanging on with their majority. It's only a 50-50 majority there. 51 with the president, vice president voting in the Senate, and only 11 or 12 vote difference in the House. And that 11 or 12 will be cut even further by 2022 because of the changes in the census, the 2020 census, and the reallocation of seats in the House, which will favor the Republicans, I believe. So, you know, by 2022, Democrats could be down to 5 or 6 seat margin. Because of this very narrow margin in the Senate and the House, that will play into the Biden wing's argument, oh, we got to be bipartisan, you see. We got to be bipartisan. One of the other legacies here of Trump is that I think more Americans now see how undemocratic the electoral process is, what the Electoral College really is, you know, created as part of this agreement in 1787 in the Constitutional Convention, you know, create the Electoral College as a check on a popular uprising, taking control of the new institutions, you know, the new House, the new, well, not the Senate so much, because then the Senate wasn't elected, you see. It was selected by the politicians in the state legislatures and backroom deals. It took an amendment to the Constitution to get us to elect our senators directly. But, of course, you know, Electoral College for the president means we still don't. Popular vote doesn't mean anything. You know, what matters are the electors. And the electors are based upon the number of people in Congress, right? The 535 people in Congress. You know, there are essentially 535 electors. I think there's three more for Washington, D.C. or something, so you get 538. Okay. You know, the Constitution, by the way, says that periodically the number of Congress people, House representatives, should be increased as the population of the country increases. Well, if you had the population increase, you would have more than 435 representatives in the House. You would have more, and probably more for blue states. So if you would have more members in the House, you would have more electors that would be pro-blue state. The last time the U.S. increased the number of representatives in the House was 1913. Yeah. So keep a note of that. You know, you may not have to abolish the Electoral College. Just follow the Constitution and increase the number of members in the House. Of course, you know, that assumes that the population shifts in the country aren't going to the red states more than the blue states. Of course, Florida, Texas, places like that are increasing population, and New York, Massachusetts, Michigan, places like that are losing. So, you know, maybe that approach does not work. But we do see now not only the limits of the Electoral College itself, but how the elite could really, if they didn't like even the results of the Electoral College, get around it. That's what Trump tried to do. You see, he revealed that, oh, the Electoral Colleges have to be the electors selected by the Electoral College, the number, had to be endorsed by the state legislatures. We saw that, didn't we? And then the governor had to send the list to Congress. And then we saw here this week how even in Congress they might be able to challenge and overturn the electors. So there's a whole number of steps that follow the Electoral College in which the elites, if they really wanted to and were in agreement, could reverse or overturn even the decision of the Electoral College. Not just the Electoral College itself being undemocratic, in other words, contrary to one person, one vote, but even it could be manipulated. We see this is for all Americans to see how undemocratic our electoral system really is, how undemocratic. And that, I think, is a legacy of Trump as well. A positive legacy in a sense, because his machinations revealed all of this, revealed, you know, how limited American democracy really is and how easy it is for the elites to turn it around. Hey, if it, just think of this, if it were Bernie Sanders, do you think that this thing would have turned out the way it did? Do you think that the Electoral College and the challenge to maybe the electors Bernie had won would not have been overturned, let alone a socialist? No. It kind of says, it points out that, you know, if the elites really don't want this or that candidate to win, they have a whole host of ways of blocking it. This is for all to see. It's a real educational experience here. We had to pay for it, you know, in significant ways. But that's a legacy, political legacy of Trump. He tore the veil off of the limits of American democracy for everybody to see. And that's not going to go away either, not for quite a long time. Okay? Nor is a white nationalist core in the Republican Party that he's created going to go away. Another political legacy is the demonization of immigrants. Yes, among, you know, maybe half of the population, you know, whether it's the African Americans who were immigrants and been here, or whether, you know, people from Latin America immigrants or Muslim Americans or whatever, you know, they are, quote, the other. The other, who are in our midst and who are changing America, stealing away the culture of white nationalist America, right, of European Americans. So these are also legacies, political legacies, right? So we'll see where all this goes, but he certainly has changed America, not to the better.